but she had turned him away. Her Lord Father promised her to Brandon Stark, and so it was to him that she gave her token, a pale blue handscarf she had embroidered with the leaping trout of Riverrun. As she pressed it into his hand, she pleaded with him. "He is only a foolish boy, but I have loved him like a brother, and it would grieve me to see him die." And her betrothed looked at her with the cool grey eyes of a Stark, and promised to spare the boy who loved her. That fight was over almost as soon as it began. Brandon was a man grown, and he drove Littlefinger all the way across the bailey and down the water stair, raining steel on him with every step, until the boy was staggering and bleeding from a dozen wounds. "Yield!" he called more than once, but Petyr would only shake his head and fight on grimly. When the river was lapping at their ankles, Brandon finally ended it with a brutal backhand cut that bit through Petyr's rings and leather into the soft flesh below the ribs, so deep that Catelyn was certain that the wound was mortal. He looked at her as he fell and murmured, "Cat," as the bright blood came flowing out between his mailed fingers. She thought she had forgotten that. That was the last time she had seen his face, until the day she was brought before him in King's Landing. A fortnight passed before Littlefinger was strong enough to leave Riverrun, but her Lord Father forbade her to visit him in the tower where he lay abed. Lysa helped their maester nurse him. She had been softer and shyer in those days. Ednor had called on him as well, but Petyr had sent him away. Her brother had acted as Brandon's squire at the duel, and Littlefinger would not forgive that. As soon as he was strong enough to be moved, Lord Hustle Tully sent Petyr Baelish away in a closed litter, to finish his healing on the fingers, upon the windswept jut of rock where he'd been born. The ringing clash of steel on steel jarred Catelyn back to the present. Savardas was coming hard at Brunn, driving into him with shield and sword. The sellsword scrambled backward, checking each blow, stepping lightly over rock and root, his eyes never leaving his foe. He was quicker, Catelyn saw. The knight's silvered sword never came near to touching him, but his own ugly grey blade hacked a notch from Savardas' shoulder plate. The brief flurry of fighting ended as swiftly as it had begun, when Brunn sidestepped and slid behind the statue of the weeping woman. Savardas lunged at where he had been, striking a spark off the pale marble of Alyssa's thigh. "They're not fighting good, Mother," the Lord of the Eyrie complained. "I want them to fight." "They will, sweet baby," his mother soothed him. "The sellsword can't run all day." Some of the lords on Lysa's terrace were making wry jests as they refilled their wine cups, but across the garden, Tyrion Lannister's mismatched eyes watched the champions dance as if there were nothing else in the world. Bronn came out from behind the statue, hard and fast, still moving left, aiming a two-handed cut at the knight's unshielded right side. Savardas blocked, but clumsily, and the sellsword's blade flashed upwards at his head. Metal rang, and a falcon's wing collapsed with a crunch. Savardas took a half-step back to brace himself, raised his shield. Oak chips flew as Bronn's sword hacked at the wooden wall. The sellsword stepped left again, away from the shield, and caught Savardas across the stomach, the razor edge of his blade leaving a bright gash where it bit into the knight's plate. Savardas drove forward off his back foot, his own silver blade descending in a savage arc. Brunn slammed it aside and danced away. The knight crashed into the weeping woman, rocking her on her plinth. Staggered, he stepped backward, his head turning this way and that as he searched for his foe. The slit visor of his helm narrowed his vision. "Behind you, sir!" Lord Hunter shouted, too late. Brunn brought his sword down with both hands, catching Savardas in the elbow of his sword arm. The thin lobster metal that protected the joint crunched. The knight groaned, turning, wrenching his weapon up. This time, Bronn stood his ground. The swords flew at each other, and their steel song filled the garden and rang off the white towers of the Eyrie.
"Sir Bardas is hurt,"
Sir Roderick said, his voice grave. Catelyn did not need to be told. She had eyes. She could see the bright finger of blood running along the knight's forearm, the wetness inside the elbow joint. Every parry was a little slower and a little lower than the one before. Sir Bardas turned his side to his foe, trying to use his shield to block instead, but Bronn slid around him, quick as a cat. The sellsword seemed to be getting stronger. His cuts were leaving their marks now. Deep, shiny gashes gleamed all over the knight's armor. On his right thigh, his beaked visor, crossing on his breastplate, a long one along the front of his gorget. The moon and falcon rondel of Sir Bardas's right arm was sheared clean in half, hanging by its strap. They could hear his labored breath rattling through the air holes in his visor. Blind with arrogance as they were, even the knights and lords of the Vale could see what was happening below them. Yet her sister could not. "Enough, Sir Bardas," Lady Eliza called down. "Finish him now. My baby is growing tired." And it must be said of Sir Bardas Egan, he was true to his lady's command, even to the last. One moment he was reeling backward, half-crouched behind his scarred shield. The next he charged. The sudden bullrush caught Bronn off balance. Sir Bardas crashed into him and slammed the lip of his shield into the sellsword's face. Almost, almost, Bronn lost his feet. He staggered back, tripped over a rock, and caught hold of the weeping woman to keep his balance. Throwing aside his shield, Sir Bardas lurched after him, using both hands to raise his sword. His right arm was blood from elbow to fingers now. Yet his last desperate blow would have opened Bronn from neck to navel, if the sellsword had stood to receive it. But Bronn jerked back. John Aaron's beautiful engraved silver sword glanced off the marble elbow of the weeping woman and snapped, clean a third of the way up the blade. Bronn put his shoulder into the statue's back. The weathered likeness of Alyssa Aaron tottered and fell with a great crash, and Sir Bardas Egan went down beneath her. Bronn was on him in a heartbeat, kicking what was left of his shattered rondel aside to expose the weak spot between arm and breastplate. Sir Bardas was lying on his side, pinned beneath the broken torso of the weeping woman. Catelyn heard the knight groan as the sellsword lifted his blade with both hands and drove it down and in with all his weight behind it, under the arm and through the ribs. Sir Bardas Egan shuddered and lay still. Silence fell over the Eyrie. Bronn yanked off his half-helm and let it fall to the grass. His lip was smashed and bloody where the shield had caught him, and his coal-black hair was soaked with sweat. He spit out a broken tooth.
"Is it over, mother?"
the Lord of the Eyrie asked. "No," Catelyn wanted to tell him. "It's only now beginning." "Yes," Lysa said glumly, her voice as cold and dead as the captain of her guard.
"Can I make the little man fly now?"
Across the garden, Tyrion Lannister got to his feet.
"Not this little man," he said. "This little man is going down in the turnipoist. Thank you very much."
"You presume," Lysa began.
"I presume that House Aaron remembers its own words," the imp said. "As high as honor." "You promised I could make him fly,"
the Lord of the Eyrie screamed at his mother. He began to shake. Lady Lysa's face was flushed with fury. "The gods have seen fit to proclaim him innocent, child. We have no choice but to free him." She lifted her voice. "Guards, take my Lord of Lannister and his creature here out of my sight. Escort them to the bloody gate and set them free. See that they have horses and supplies sufficient to reach the Trident. and make certain all their goods and weapons are returned to them. They shall have need of them. On the high road?
The high road, Tyrion Lannister said.
Lysa allowed herself a faint, satisfied smile. It was another sort of death sentence, Catelyn realized. Tyrion Lannister must know that as well, yet the dwarf favoured Lady Arryn with a mocking bow.
As you command, my lady, he said, I believe we know the way.
John.
You are as hopeless as any boys I've ever trained,
Sir Alistair Thorne announced when they had all assembled in the yard.
Your hands were made for manure shovels, not for swords, and if it was up to me, the lot of you would be sent to herding swine. But last night, I was told that Gurin is marching 5 new boys up the King's Road. 1 or 2 may even be worth the price of piss. To make room for them, I have decided to pass 8 of you onto the Lord Commander, to do with as he will.
He called out the names one by one.
Toad, Stonehead, Oryx, Lover, Pimple, Monkey, Saloon.
Last of all, he looked at John.
And a bastard.
Pip let fly a whoop and thrust his sword in the air. Sir Alistair fixed him with a reptile stare.
They will call you men of the Night's Watch now, but you are bigger fools than the mummer's monkey here, if you believe that. You are boys still, green and stinking of summer. And when the winter comes, you will die like flies.
And with that, Sir Alistair Thorne took his leave of them. The other boys gathered round the 8 who had been named, laughing and cursing and offering congratulations. Haldor smacked Toad on the butt with the flat of his sword and shouted, Toad of the Night's Watch! Yelling that a black brother needed a horse, Pip leapt under Gren's shoulders, and they tumbled to the ground, rolling and punching and hooting. Darien dashed inside the armory and returned with a skin of sour red. As they passed the wine from hand to hand, grinning like fools, John noticed Samuel Tarly standing by himself beneath a bare, dead tree in the corner of the yard. John offered him the skin. A swallow of wine? Sam shook his head.
No, thank you, John.
Are you well?
Very well, truly, the fat boy lied. I'm so happy for you all.
His round face quivered as he forced a smile.
You will be First Ranger some day, just as your uncle was.
Is, John corrected. He would not accept that Benjen Stark was dead. Before he could say more, Haldor cried, Here, you planning to drink that all yourself? Pip snatched the skin from his hand and danced away laughing. While Gren seized his arm, Pip gave the skin a squeeze, and a thin stream of red squirted John in the face. Haldor howled in protest at the waste of good wine. John sputtered and struggled. Matha and Jerin climbed the wall and began pelting them all with snowballs. By the time he wrenched free, with snow in his hair and wine stains on his surcoat, Samwell Tarly had gone. That night, Three Finger Hub cooked the boys a special meal to mark the occasion. When John arrived at the common hall, the Lord Steward himself led him to the bench near the fire. The older men clapped him on the arm in passing. The 8 soon-to-be brothers feasted on rack of lamb baked in a crust of garlic and herbs, garnished with sprigs of mint, and surrounded by mashed yellow turnips swimming in butter.
From the Lord Commander's own table,
Bowen Marsh told them. There were salads of spinach and chickpeas and turnip greens, and afterwards bowls of iced blueberries and sweet cream.
Do you think they'll keep us together?
Pip wondered, as they gorged themselves happily. Toad made a face.
I hope not. I'm sick of looking at those ears of yours.
Ho, said Pip, listen to the crow called a raven black. You're certain to be a ranger toad. They'll want you as far from the castle as they can. If Mance Raider attacks, lift your visor and show your face, and he'll run off screaming. Everyone laughed but Gren. I hope I'm a ranger. You and everyone else, said Mathar. Every man who wore the black walked the wall, and every man was expected to take up steel in its defense. But the rangers were the true fighting heart of the Night's Watch. It was they who dared to ride beyond the wall, sweeping through the haunted forest and the icy mountain heights west of the Shadow Tower, fighting wildlings and giants and monstrous snow bears. Not everyone, said Halder. It's the builders for me. What use would rangers be if the wall fell down? The Order of Builders provided the masons and carpenters to repair keeps and towers, the miners to dig tunnels and crush stone for roads and footpaths, the woodsmen to clear away new growth, wherever the forest pressed too close to the wall. Once, it was said, they had quarried immense blocks of ice from frozen lakes deep in the haunted forest, dragged them south on sledges so the wall might be raised even higher. Those days were centuries gone, however. Now it was all they could do to ride the wall from East Watch to the Shadow Tower, watching for cracks or signs of melt, or making what repairs they could. The old bear's no fool, Darien observed. You're certain to be a builder, and John's certain to be a ranger. He's the best sword and the best rider among us, and his uncle was the first before he... His voice trailed off awkwardly as he realized what he had almost said. Benjamin Stark is still first ranger, John Snow told him, toying with his bowl of blueberries. The rest might have given up all hope of his uncle's safe return, but not him. He pushed away the berries, scarcely touched, and rose from the bench. Aren't you going to eat those? Toad asked. They're yours. John had hardly tasted Hub's great feast. I could not eat another bite. He took his cloak from his hook near the door and shouldered his way out. Pip followed him. John, what is it? Sam, he admitted. He was not at table tonight. It's not like him to miss a meal, Pip said thoughtfully. Do you suppose he's taken ill? He's frightened. We're leaving him. He remembered the day he had left Winterfell, all the bittersweet farewells, Bran lying broken, Rob with snow in his hair, Arya raining kisses on him after he'd given her needle. Once we say our words, we all have duties to attend to. Some of us may be sent away to Eastwatch or the Shadow Tower. Sam will remain in training with the likes of Rast and Cougar and all these new boys who are coming up the King's Road. God only knows what they will be like, but you can bet Sir Alistair will send them against him first chance he gets. Pip made a grimace. You did all you could. All we could wasn't enough, John said. A deep restlessness was on him as he went back to Harden's Tower for Ghost. The direwolf walked beside him to the stables. Some of the more skittish horses kicked at their stalls and laid back their ears as they entered. John saddled his mare, mounted, and rode out from Castle Black, south across the moonlit night. Ghost raced ahead of him, flying over the ground, gone in the blink of an eye. John let him go. A wolf needed to hunt. He had no destination in mind, he only wanted to ride. He followed the creek for a time, listening to the icy trickle of water over the rocks, then cut across the fields to the King's Road. It stretched out before him, narrow and stony, and pocked with weeds. A road of no particular promise, yet the sight of it filled John Snow with a vast longing. Winterfell was down that road, and beyond it, River Run and King's Landing, and the Eyrie and so many other places. Castle Rock, the Isles of Faces, the Red Mountains of Dawn, the Hundred Islands of Bravos in the sea. The smoking ruins of old Valyria, all the places John would never see. The world was down that road, and he was here. Once he swore his vow, the wall would be his home until he was as old as Maester Aemon. "I'm not sworn yet," he muttered. He was no outlaw, bound to take the black, or pay the penalty for his crimes. He had come here freely, and he might leave freely, until he said the words. He need only ride on, and he could leave it all behind. By the time the moon was full again, he would be back in Winterfell with his brothers. "Your half-brothers," a voice inside him reminded him, "and Lady Stark, who will not welcome you." There was no place for him in Winterfell, no place in King's Landing either. Even his own mother had not had a place for him. The thought of her made him sad. He wondered who she had been, what she looked like, why his father had left her. Because she was a whore or an adulterous fool, something dark and dishonorable. Or else, why was Lord Eddard too ashamed to speak of her? Jon Snow turned away from the King's Road to look behind him. The fires of Castle Black were hidden behind a hill, but the wall was there, pale beneath the moon, vast and cold, running from horizon to horizon. He wheeled his horse around and started for home. Ghost returned as he crested a rise and saw the distant glow of lamplight from the Lord Commander's tower. The direwolf's muzzle was red with blood as he trotted beside the horse. John found himself thinking of Samwell Tarly again on the ride back. By the time he reached the stables, he knew what he must do. Maester Aemon's apartments were in a stout wooden keep below the rookery. Aged and frail, the maester shared his chambers with two of the younger stewards, who tended to his needs and helped him in his duties. The brothers joked that he had been given the two ugliest men in the night's watch. Being blind, he was spared having to look at them. Clydus was short, bald, and chinless, with small pink eyes like a mole. Chet had a wen on his neck, the size of a pigeon's egg, and a face red with boils and pimples. Perhaps that was why he always seemed so angry. It was Chet who answered John's knock. "I need to speak to Maester Aemon," John told him. "The maester is abed, as you should be. Come back on the morrow, and maybe he'll see you." He began to shut the door. John jammed it open with his boot. "I need to speak to him now. The morning will be too late." Chet scowled. "The maester is not accustomed to being woken in the night. Do you know how old he is?"
"Old enough to treat visitors with more courtesy than you," John said. "Give him my pardons. I would not disturb his rest if it were not important.
And if I refuse?"
John had his boot wedged solidly in the door.
"I can stand here all night if I must."
The black brother made a disgusted noise and opened the door to admit him.
"Wait in the library. There's wood stutter fire. I won't have the maester catching a chill on account of you."
John had the logs crackling merrily by the time Chet led in Maester Aemon. The old man was clad in his bedrobe, but round his throat was the chain collar of his order. A maester did not remove it even to sleep.
"The chair beside the fire would be pleasant," he said, when he felt the warmth on his face.
When he was seated comfortably, Chet covered his legs with a fur and went to stand by the door. "I'm sorry to have woken you, maester," Jon Snow said.
"You did not wake me," Maester Aemon replied. "I find I need less sleep as I grow older, and I'm grown very old. I often spend half the night with ghosts, remembering times 50 years past, as if it were yesterday. The mystery of a midnight visitor is a welcome diversion. So tell me, Jon Snow, why have you come calling at this strange hour?"
to ask that Samuel Tarley be taken from training and accepted as a brother of the Night's Watch.
"This is no concern of Maester Aemon's," Chet complained.